Science Friday is supported by Progressive. Now, most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When I was a teenager, my doctor described me as his human pincushion. I guess it was his way of making me feel good about getting half a dozen allergy shots a week. I was allergic to pollens, grasses, and weeds, and three shots in each arm was how medical science in the 60s tried to calm my asthma attacks. My seasonal allergies since went away 10 years after stopping my shots mysteriously. No one knows how that happened, but I'm always reminded of them each year as the weather warms, the trees bloom, and then wham, folks get hit over the head with the symptoms of seasonal allergies. You scramble to find some over-the-counter drug to treat it. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. You end up living through some of the most beautiful months of the year with itchy eyes, a runny nose. You feel generally miserable. You really can't enjoy it. And for the 50 million people in the U.S. with seasonal allergies, I bet that scenario feels pretty familiar. 15% of the population is suffering. That's more than the number of people with diabetes in this country. And yet we don't have any way to prevent them. And sure, you can pay for immunotherapy, years and years of allergy shots. That hasn't changed. But a silver bullet for allergies? Well, we're not quite there yet. But there's some promising research and some good theories, including one involving the microbiome that leaves the door open for better treatments down the road. Well, as every allergy sufferer knows, some relief is better than nothing sometimes. That's what we're going to be talking about this hour. If you'd like to join us, maybe you suffer from allergies, our number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. I'm sure there are lots of you out there with this seasonal affliction. Let me introduce my guests. Susan Lynch is Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Lynch, welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you.
And also joining us is Matthew Rank, an Associate Professor of Medicine at the Mayo Clinic School of Medicine in Scottsdale, Arizona. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks.
As I say, our number is 844-724-8255 if you would like to join in the discussion. Let's get down to basics first, Dr. Rank. What makes something an allergen? Why are we allergic to things like pollens and grasses and stuff like that?
It's all about how our immune system handles its environment. So if it sees something it doesn't like an allergen, and decides to make an immune response that is allergic, it results in very bothersome symptoms: nasal congestion, sneezing, dripping, eye itching, asthma like you had. And for some people, the person and their immune system simply ignores that allergen like the harmless invader it really is. Others develop an immune problem and develop allergies.
I'm curious about those allergy shots because I can't believe we still do it the same way.
Yeah. Since about 1909, allergy shots are one way that we try to educate or train the immune system to become tolerant of those allergens. So similar to in the 1960s, we gradually expose people to the things that we think they're allergic to and basically trick the immune system to accepting them rather than overreacting to them. Things have changed a little bit since the 1960s. We have a better idea about which doses to use and better quality extracts to treat people with. But the concept, and we have a better understanding of the mechanism of immune tolerance, but the concepts are largely the same.
Hmm. And Dr. Lynch, I want to turn to you about the work you are involved in with the microbiome. How? It's one of our favorite topics on Science Friday. If you listen, you know. So I'm very curious to know how the microbiome fits into all of this.
Sure. The microbiome is one of my favorite topics as well. So we were really interested in understanding the genesis of allergies. And so we turned to very young babies to understand whether the microbes in their gut may be different in those children who developed allergies and actually asthma as well in childhood versus those who did not. And we looked at the stool of one-month-old babies and found that they were not all the same, that there were three distinct types of gut microbiomes in those children. And that one of them, those children who had that type of gut microbiome were at heightened risk of allergies at age two and asthma at age four. And it turns out that within that gut microbiome, those infants are lacking a whole range of commensal bacteria that we know produce things like short-chain fatty acids that induce the very types of immune cells that quench allergic inflammation. And conversely, they were quite enriched for a whole range of fungi that we also know are pro-allergic. And we went on to show that the products associated with that high-risk gut microbiome in those one-month-old babies could actually induce allergic responses from previously healthy immune cells from adult donors. So suggesting that, you know, at least for childhood allergy development, that the canary in the coal mine may actually be the gut microbiome in the very earliest stages of life that is producing products that drive allergic responses from those children and quenches the capacity to downregulate inflammation that prevents allergic response.
Do you have any idea where that microbiome might get started, that particular kind of microbiome?
That's a great question. Certainly, there is evidence from our group and from others that the environment that children are raised in may, in fact, serve as a library of microbes for the microbiome that develops on in the airways and then gastrointestinal tract. And we've shown that children in even the inner city, which we think of as a kind of microbial desert, but it turns out it's not. There's a gradient of microbial exposure within the inner city. And in homes in which children have exposure in very early life to a broad range of bacteria, mm-hmm. they're the children that do not develop allergies. And conversely, those children who are raised in homes that lack these bacteria that we find in the gut and the airway and protect against pathogens and against allergens, they're missing from the environment of those mm-hmm. infants. But there's several other factors that play into this equation as well. It's not simply the environment. The diet that children receive also influences the types and activities of the microbiome, as well as antimicrobial exposure and a range of other factors that we know are risk factors for developing the disease in childhood.
Dr. Reich, let's talk about the pathways, about how the immune system responds when it responds to allergens. And maybe then we can think about how the microbiome might play into that.
Sure. So the immune system has a number of choices it can make, and there's a whole spectrum of decisions it can make along the way in exposure to different things. So as Dr. Lynch discussed, if the immune system in a critical time period in, say, infancy is exposed to a diversity of microbes, it can make an immune response that's less allergic. If not, that same person can develop more of an allergic response. These have traditionally been called Th1, the non-allergic, and Th2, the allergic responses. However, we're learning a lot more about those particular immune responses, the different components, an immune tolerance, pathway, and those pathways really can be set even from infancy, then for the rest of life, even perhaps. And so, the focus of Dr. Lynch and others team's research has really been in that critical time period in these young children, and on those particular lifestyle and changes that have occurred in the last 40 to 50 years in our mm-hmm. society.
So is it possible, Dr. Lynch, that the gut microorganisms are sort of flipping the switch between these pathways in the immune system?
That's what we think. That's the developing hypothesis, that the colonization of the early life gut, or perhaps even in adulthood, a perturbation to the gut microbiome that results in enrichment of some of these less than desirable microorganisms, results in the presentation of microbial antigens to the host, as well as microbial products to the host that really skew immune function towards that of a pro-allergic response.
Mm-hmm. What is the difference between an allergy, let's say, to pollens, grasses, and weeds, and an allergy and being allergic to something like gluten in bread products, things like that? Is it the same mechanism that's going on?
It's a little bit different. So most people that are having gluten responses are having an immunologic response that can be described as having celiac disease. This immune response is different than somebody who would have an allergic response to, say, peanut or shellfish, where you consume the food and within 15 to 20 minutes you develop rash, swelling, vomiting, diarrhea, maybe even breathing problems, maybe even pass out. So those are different mechanisms. We generally term the reactions like celiac disease or in a food intolerance category, and the other immediate type allergy in what we call food allergy. However, talk to patients all day, and basically anything that happens to somebody after an exposure, whether it's medicine or pollen or foods, in general terms, is labeled an allergy by the general public.
Right.
And so we try to help sort through those things by understanding the mechanisms and the appropriate tests that can be used to confirm them, but it's not always easy.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk to you about something interesting we came across. There was a study that made headlines last year that they looked at the Amish and the Hutterite communities and found very different results about their allergies, Dr. Rank.
Yeah, that's a really interesting study. So the interesting thing about the Hutterites and the Amish are they have different farming practices. The Hutterites follow a more industrial farming practice, and the Amish a very traditional farming practice. Some very smart researchers decided to take advantage of these differences and learn about how their immune systems may be different. First, they found that the allergy and asthma rate were far lower in the Amish, which they kind of already knew before based on other previous studies. But what they didn't know before was the immune mechanisms involved in those differences. And they found actually that the innate immune system, which is kind of the part where our body first sees a potential allergen or pathogen, was abnormal and was the part that was really different. What they were able to do was take the dust that an Amish child would be exposed to and actually do some elegant experiments in mice and show that that dust would basically make allergy and asthma go away. They take the same dust from the Hutterite family household and couldn't make that happen.
Wow. Let me interrupt you because we have to take a break, and I want you to to finish that thought because it's an interesting study. We're going to take a break. 844-724-8255. Lots of people on the line. We'll get back to this Amish and Hutterite story after the break. Stay with us.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
If you just joined us, you're listening to Science Friday from PRI, and we are talking about allergies, because it is the allergy hay fever, that terrible season of the year, people is coughing and sneezing, hacking, all kinds of stuff. And we're talking about allergies with Dr. Susan Lynch and Dr. Matthew Rank. And Dr. Rank was talking about this interesting study of the Amish and the Hutterite communities and how even though they're both isolated communities, they have totally different reactions to their environment. Continue. Pick up where you left off.
Sure.
You took the dust from one community and gave it to the other and then gave it to mice, or what happened?
Nope. They took the dust from the Amish and the Hutterite communities, and they exposed mice to those as a way to try to train the mice's immune system, and they found that the dust from the Amish, the more traditional farming community, was able to significantly reduce the allergic and asthma responses in mice, again, suggesting that the important key elements are within that environmental exposure, whereas the same dust from the Hutterite, the more industrial farming, just did not show that same reduction.
Hmm. And that conclusion means what? How do you?
I think the main conclusion is that the things that we're exposed to in our environment, the microbes and not, maybe not even just microbes, but other things that are in that exposure, are really important for the development of allergy or tolerance.
Dr. Lynch, does this study fit the theory that the microbiome might play a role?
Absolutely. And, you know, we have to consider that we are constantly exposed to microbes and they are playing with our immune system all the time. And they get to colonize the surfaces in our body, in the upper airways and in the gastrointestinal tract. So a really interesting aside on that study is that in the Hutterite farms, the farmers change their clothes in their barns, so they don't bring the microbial exposures in their barns into their living environment. And that's one of the ideas that is bandied about, that it's a lack of exposure to these tolerizing microbes in the environment that plays a large role in dictating allergic response.
All right, we have the phones are lit up, as they say in the radio business. I'm going to go to some calls. Let's go to Cincinnati to Debbie. Hi, welcome to Science Friday. Debbie, are you there?
Hello, Ira. Yes, I am. Thanks for taking my call. I do have questions. I was just wondering how on earth I can find a doctor. I moved from Kansas 7 years ago, and 4 years ago, to Cincinnati, we moved 7 years ago, and we have moved into an area that everyone will tell you if you ask them, you don't live here long enough, you will develop allergies. And I guess my allergies have gone into asthma. I don't really remember having allergies. I went straight to asthma. So I feel like my doctor, I have 2 prescriptions I'm on right now, and that's the only option I have. And I wondered, can I find a specialist?
All right, let me interrupt because your cell phone is sort of cutting in and out. And what you want to know is how do you go about finding a good allergist, a good physician?
I'll take that one.
Yes, go ahead, Dr. Ryan.
I think you could start by talking to your regular doctor. Often they'll have a really good idea who the best doctors are. They make referrals and they get feedback. There are also many resources online. The American Academy of Allergy, the American College of Allergy, both have websites with listings of allergists that are specialists. I think another way to get good advice is talking to people you trust, friends, family, who have had experiences. Chances are, if you have allergy problems, many in your family do as well.
We have a tweet from Karen Ippen who says, how does heredity factor into allergies? Good question.
That's a really good question.
Please go ahead.
Sorry. So there's certainly risk genes that have been associated with increased chances of developing allergies and asthma, things like ORMDL3. And so there is clearly a hereditary component of this. But I think that the rapid increase in the rate and prevalence of allergic disease over the last several decades suggests that this is not simply down to host genetics. I would also like the audience to think as well that it's not just host genes that we pass on to our offspring. There's actually microbes that are transmitted vertically from mother to child during the birthing process. So it's not just host genes, it's microbial genes as well that may be driving some of this, and that vertical transmission may be compounded over generations is one of the hypotheses that's in the field right now.
That brings me to Jessica in Murray, Kentucky, who I might have a comment about that. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. I was wondering if in the studies looking at infants in particular, if you saw any impacts of breastfeeding with regard to the intestinal flora.
We certainly know from studies outside of our own that breastfeeding appears to promote the types of organisms that produce molecules that allow us to respond appropriately to allergens, that allowed us to quench allergic responses. In our study of the one-month-old babies, we actually did not see a significant difference in breastfeeding frequency between the high-risk and the lower-risk groups. But that may be because our numbers were small. We had 11 children who were in the high-risk group. So that's always a caution with smaller studies. And we certainly know that breastfeeding is associated with promotion of the types of organisms that we need to quench allergic response.
Here's a tweet came in from Morning Morning who says, been eating honey from a hive in my hood. I imagine that it's raw honey. I haven't had to take medications. Coincidence? I've heard a lot of anecdotal stuff about honey.
We have a lot of patients coming and asking us about this. And like with a lot of different treatment options in allergy, some have been studied better than others. Some we have more confidence in how well they work. And local honey is one of those treatments where we really just don't know how well it works. We really don't have the studies with the right rigor that we need to judge how effective it may be. So I usually steer patients to treatments that we know may be more, that we have more confidence are that they're effective. But I don't discount the possibility that this could be an effective treatment after we've studied it more carefully.
Yeah, because there's no money really if it's local honey into, doing a study. So.
That's right. The support would have to come from somebody who really wanted to do that study and wouldn't potentially be able to benefit monetarily.
That's $100 million we're talking about, something like that. Let's go to Maryland. Andrea in Maryland. Hi, welcome.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I want to start with a quick history before I ask my question. About 2 years ago, at the advice of my father, who's a nutritionist, who's been spousing this for many years, I dropped all dairy from my diet, and I started probiotics and prebiotics. And I have not had any seasonal allergies for the last two seasons since I changed my diet. So here's my question. Is it possible that you have, as I try to explain it to people, you have X number of soldiers that are fighting your allergies, and if you have a food allergy that you don't know about that's using up some of these soldiers, and you don't have enough, your immune system is not strong enough or not, doesn't have enough of these quote-unquote soldiers to fight the seasonal allergies that you're discussing.
Hmm. Dr. Lynch, Dr. Rank? Calling Dr.
Sure.
Lynch, Dr. Rank?
Sure.
Well, I think, a change in diet begets a change in the types of microbes and their products in the gastrointestinal tract. That's a given. And the fact that you're seeing a change of diet also with an introduction of probiotics as being beneficial is quite interesting because it mirrors a study that was performed in infants with cow's milk allergy. And those infants who received cow's milk with the lactobacillus supplemented into the cow's milk actually showed a significant reduction in their cow's milk allergy following a year of that type of mode of feeding. So I think what it suggests, and your anecdotal evidence suggests as well, is that it may be a combination of providing the right foodstuffs as well as the right microbial machines to convert those foods into molecules that reduce inflammation and allergic responses.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about
it.
Go ahead, Dr. Rank.
I would completely agree with the mechanistic suggestion from Dr. Lynch. I would add, though, a note of caution that we really don't know how well those dietary changes or those pre or probiotics work in reversing or changing immune tolerance. We still have a lot more work to do in that field.
A couple of questions, one from my own experience, one from people who have been asking about nut allergies. How come, when I was growing up, I never heard the word nut allergies. Is it just going undiscovered, so to speak?
Let me start with that one, but I do want to give Dr. Lynch a chance as well for this one. We think there's been a significant increase in nut allergies, and we think this is likely related to a number of factors, a number that Dr. Lynch has already mentioned, changes in lifestyle, changes in diet, changes in antibiotics, changes in our microbiome. And we don't fully and completely understand the relative contribution of each of these factors, but we've clearly observed, I think most would agree, an increased prevalence in all these food allergies.
An increased prevalence in food allergies? Wow. And any hypothesis why that might be?
Well, there's a number of theories, I think. I think we've changed quite dramatically how we produce food, and that may also change the content of the food and indeed even the microbial payload that comes along with the food. Microbes do not have to be live to induce an immune response. I think that that's an important point to be considered. That the sugars that decorate their membranes and their DNA themselves can act as signals to provoke an immune response. But I'd like to also mention a really very quite elegant study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine a couple of years ago. I think the idea for a number of years has been that if we avoid allergens, that would help promote tolerance to them. And in fact, quite the opposite has been shown in a study of very young children in which early life exposure to peanut products significantly reduced the incidence of peanut allergic responses in those children. It was a quite eye-opening study that really turned on its head this idea that allergen exposure may be the appropriate approach to prevent allergies.
It's interesting because we had a tweet from Sharon, actually on Facebook, came in and said, I have recently developed an allergy to animal dander after taking a job in a vet clinic. Can increased exposure cause an allergy, or does the change in exposure ramp up an existing one?
Yep, that's a great question. We see a lot of people that are having symptoms around their pets. We see a lot of people working in labs or working in vet offices that come in with animal dander allergy. And some people can completely tolerate that without developing an allergy. Others will develop that allergy. And the rate or the exposure rate to that is not always clearly the reason for why that happens. Mm-hmm. We believe that people have a genetic predisposition to potentially develop allergy, and the environmental exposures that happen along the way, perhaps significantly influenced by the microbiome, are what ultimately influence whether that person develops allergy. And it's quite variable, in at least from where I sit in the clinic talking to patients with allergies every day.
Well, another Facebook from John says something very interesting along those lines, which is some allergies seem to sensitize with repeated exposure, meaning shellfish, while some habituate with low incremental increasing doses, such as peanut and nut allergies. Why is that one thing, yin and yang of that?
Yeah, I think that really gets to the heart of how immune tolerance is developed. And the timing of when those exposures occur, the frequency and the dosing, all those things matter quite a bit. So what's happening right now, and Dr. Lynch nicely highlighted, is a shift in our approach to thinking about food allergy and trying to promote tolerance. And that very important study she mentioned called the LEAP study, where before we thought, if we just don't expose children to foods during that critical time where they may develop food allergy, they just won't end up developing that food allergy. In fact, with really carefully designed trials, we found that wasn't the case at all. In fact, we need to expose children earlier to train their immune system to tolerate those things. So that early life time frame is critical, whereas later in life, it may not be so critical. On the other hand, there are plenty of adults that develop allergy, hay fever, seasonal allergies, asthma-type problems, food allergies. So it's not the same. It doesn't work that way for everybody.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking about allergies with Dr. Susan Lynch, Associate Professor of Medicine, UC San Francisco, Dr. Matthew Rank, Associate Professor of Medicine at the Mayo Clinic School of Medicine in Scottsdale, not in Rochester, in Scottsdale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It seems like this is such an incredible, and we could go on all day. I have a lit up board of phone calls and tweets coming in. It's something everybody, and now I guess this time of the year. And let me ask you, because we only have a few minutes left, is this a bad or worse year than normal that you've seen? Let me ask you, Dr. Rank, and then Dr. Lynch.
Sure. Most who've looked at the data would say that each year may be a little bit worse. There are several factors that may contribute to this. One of them is urbanization. We grow and plant things, and they seem to grow better when it's warmer on heat islands and urban areas. And some allergens grow better in conditions in our polluted air. The second factor is overall warmth of temperature across our country and across the world. There are longer pollen seasons, and this promotes more pollen to develop. And so each year we may expect to see this be a little bit worse. Pretty clear that the pollen seasons, the further we get away from the equator, have significantly lengthened in time.
Climate change. Yeah. Dr. Lynch, you agree?
I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. And again, it may be, again, about that, as the earlier caller had mentioned, that it increased and prolonged exposure may be part of the issue.
Mm-hmm. And so the first thing that people should do if you say that in later in life they can develop allergies is go mm-hmm. see your physician, try to figure out what it is first. Get those allergy tests. I had 100 allergy tests on my arm years ago, both arms. Are they still doing that?
Yep. That's still one of the best ways to determine if somebody's sensitive to a particular allergen. The reaction in the skin tends to mimic pretty well what happens in the gut or happens in the nose or lungs. Not perfect. There are some additional advanced diagnostic tools that people are working on.
Was I just lucky that I grew out of it? Just something we don't know why?
Well, we think that being on allergy shots and training the immune system in that way helps people outgrow them. Often for a long time, it's one of the ways to try to retrain the immune system after someone's already acquired allergy.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you very much, because I say we've got lots of people. We'll send them to our website to get some of the resources. Dr. Susan Lynch, Associate Professor of Medicine, UC San Francisco. Dr. Matthew Rank, Associate Professor, professor out today, of Medicine at the Mayo Clinic School of Medicine in Scottsdale. And I mean, in Scottsdale, wasn't that the place people went for their get away from allergies? Not so much anymore?
Used to be.
Used to be. That's set up. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. After the break, an innovation that melds muscles and nerves in an amputated limb and could bring more sensory feedback to bionic limbs. We are still doing amputations like we did during the Civil War. Maybe that will change now that we have bionic limbs and we want to hook up the muscles to them. We'll talk about it after the break, so stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you're not driving right now, I mean not driving, I'd like you to do a little experiment with me. Ready? Close your eyes, hold your arm out straight in front of you, and then slowly bend your arm up, let's about 45 degrees. Okay, you can open your eyes and check. How close did you get to that 45? Pretty close. But you have ever thought about the reason you can do that, how you know where your body is in space at any moment in time? It's because your muscle sends a lot of information back to your spinal cord, information on its length, the speed of its contraction, the force it's up against. And all that sense information gives your brain a perfect picture of what's going on with your arm. You get that hand-eye coordination, but you don't even need to have your eyes open to do that. But people with bionic arms and legs and ankles and feet, they don't get all that sensory feedback on the movement and torque of their limbs. But my next guest is working on a technique that may bring some of that feeling back. Shriya Srinivasan is a PhD candidate in the Health Sciences and Technology program at MIT and at Harvard. At the same time, and one of the authors of a new study on amputations and bionic limbs in the journal Science Robotics. Welcome to Science Friday, Shriya.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
Let's talk about that example I talked about in the intro to the segment, moving your arm, your eyes closed, and still knowing where your arm is. Walk us through what's happening there with all the nerves and the muscles.
Absolutely. This is based on the fundamental motor unit of the human body, which is the agonist and antagonist muscle pair. And you have one of these muscle pairs for each joint. So take, for example, the biceps and triceps. They form an agonist-antagonist pair. And when you contract your biceps, like you had mentioned, your elbow flexes and your triceps undergo a stretch. And this stretch signal is sent to your brain to let you know where your arm is in space, how fast it's moving, and the kind of weight or load that it might be up against. The bicep-tricep pairing also allows you to be able to control how stiff your arm is when you move it. And this sensory feedback information really allows people to have fine motor control. It allows you to plan your trajectory without having to think about it or visually track your limbs. And it's really important for having smooth and continuous movement.
Mm-hmm. We talked with your colleague, Hugh Herr, who's also working on this project, who lost his lower legs in an ice climbing accident, so he has personal experience with the current limitations of bionics. He couldn't join us today, but here's a clip from that conversation.
When I move my bionic ankles, I don't feel the movement of the ankles. And when the torque increases on my bionic ankle joints, I don't feel that torque. So we're aiming to give those sensations back to the bionic limb user.
And to do that, you have to get away from the technique, as I say, that's, what, 100, 200, 300 years old, of just hacking off a limb and let it dangle there.
Yeah, so the standard amputation paradigm hasn't changed in about 200 years. We look at Civil War textbooks and we see the same sort of procedures and protocols that we use today in the clinic. And it essentially involves cutting through the skin and the muscle and then finally the bone at the site of amputation and wrapping the muscles around that area and closing the skin around it. And what's severed is all the nerves that are controlling your muscles and this fundamental agonist-antagonist muscle relationship. And so the prosthetic user today now has to follow around their limbs visually in order to know what's going on and has very little sensory feedback information. In our new amputation paradigm, we're surgically and mechanically linking regenerative pieces of muscle to each of our nerves and having these linked so that when one contracts, the other one automatically stretches and sends that feedback signal to the brain. And because we'll have muscle pairs, we can also take these signals out and have finer prosthetic control and be able to modulate position, velocity, and stiffness of prosthetic devices, which is a significant improvement to the clinical standard.
So what kind of attachment and contact do you have to make at the site where the muscles are that you've cut into?
So do you mean in terms of the nerves or the sensors that we will be interfacing?
Yeah, the sensors that you're putting in.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are things like implantable myoelectric sensors, which record muscle signals. There's also standard muscle electrodes that we can interface with these muscle grafts. And these will be wirelessly communicating with prosthetic devices to which we can send muscle signals.
Hmm. So you sort of build a sort of little Band-Aid made out of muscle that you would apply to an amputated limb?
Yeah, essentially, yeah. We have these muscle pairs that are created, one for each degree of freedom.
Yeah.
And these will all sit within the residuum. And for each of these pairs, we'll have a set of sensors which will tell the prosthetic device, you know, whether how to move those joints.
Do surgeons who are doing amputations, are they in on this now? Are they thinking ahead before they do the surgery on the limb and do the amputation?
I think as this research gets out there, the hope is that they will continue and start to realize the potential that this will offer and that this will hopefully become the standard for people maybe, you know, a decade from now. But I think we're also in a continual process of developing the robotic technology and making those advanced prosthetic devices that can leverage these dynamic muscle constructs commercially available. Hmm. And so the goal is, you know, in a decade that this will become the standard.
How long have people been thinking about doing this new technique?
You know, it's surprising to us that something like this hasn't been created before, but I think it's only relatively within the last decade, actually, that people have thought about re-engineering the amputation paradigm in order to increase the functionality of devices that are interfaced with it.
Mm. I know that this study was just done in rats, right? Have you tried it in human subjects yet, or is that coming soon?
We're actually rapidly transitioning to humans and starting to put these surgeries into them. So we'll see how that goes.
And would this only work for new amputees?
No, so actually the benefit of this amputation paradigm is that we'd be able to use residual musculature or grafts from other part of the body and do this as a revision procedure to people that have already had amputations. So Hugh, for example, we could take some muscles from other parts of his body and put those into grafted locations within his residual limb. And so this amputation is actually applicable to a broad range of amputees, both prophylactically and revision surgeries.
Is Hugh going to be the first person to have this done?
I'm not sure, but he's definitely interested in having this done.
I got to ask you before we go, why one university is not good enough? You have to do MIT and Harvard at the same time.
You know, it's been a great journey, and I think the interdisciplinary kind of exposure and approach that we've taken is a result of this collaboration between the universities, bringing in, you know, the mechatronics, the mechanics, the biomechanics, the robotics, and the neuroscience and surgery. Mm. So all these aspects we're able to join as we increase the expertise.
So when somebody, one side wants to study it forever, and the other side says, let's just do it and learn it as we go on. All right. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, we have people from both the clinical world and the engineering world coming together, and that really helped us come up with this method.
That sounds great. We'll check back with us, okay, as you make progress on this.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Shreya Srinivasan is a PhD candidate in the health sciences and technology programs, both at MIT and in Harvard. Thanks for joining us. Imagine you're out for a jog or you need a little extra oomph. Do you visualize a bear chasing you? Take a swig of some sports drink? Or do you just turn up your exosuit up to high? Writing this week in the journal Science Robotics, researchers describe work on a belt and shorts in their lab test that could help a person use about 5% less energy when running. They think they can improve that number even more. Joining me to talk about that creation is Philip Malcolm. He's an assistant professor, Department of Biomechanics at the Center for Research in Human Movement Variability, University of Nebraska at Omaha. He joins me by Skype. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
So I mentioned this word called exosuit. What is an exosuit? Is that like this, the thing we see Iron Man wearing?
No, it's actually quite a different Iron Man. He wears what we scientists would call a rigid exoskeleton. So it's composed of beams and rigid plates and joints. An exosuit is actually composed of functional apparel or textiles that anchor to different parts of the body. And then there are flexible cables that pull between these parts.
So you have a big waist belt connected with cables to the shorts that go on the upper legs?
This version of the exosuit, indeed, it's composed of a waist belt and two wraps that go around the thighs. And then there's a cable that pulls between those two components and acts like a second pair of hip extension muscles that act in parallel to your own hip extensor muscles. But the lab of Dr. Walsh at Harvard University is also working on different other versions of the exosuit that assist with plantar flexion or other movements.
So you're sort of giving them an extra set of muscles without having to give them an extra set of muscles.
That's the underlying idea, and could have like a lot of different applications. One thing I also want to point out about this particular study is that we were able to reduce the energy cost of running, but it's actually running on a treadmill. And the motor, the actuation unit that drives the exosuit was actually stationary and positioned next to a treadmill. So this is kind of a preliminary step in this type of research.
You can't go very far when you're hooked to the treadmill, can you?
You
have to shrink this down and make it portable, right? If you're going to...
Definitely the engineers at the lab of Dr. Walsh are already planning and working on this. Also, if you look at the past, at earlier developments on exoskeletons and exosuits for walking, that's also how those developments happened first. It's done with what we call an off-board approach. So the actuation unit is next to a treadmill that gives the advantage that it's much more versatile, much more programmable, and that the person doesn't have to carry the weight.
Right.
And once we figure out which type of assistance is needed to assist the person, which appears to be like quite difficult to find, then we can use that information for designing a portable device.
Does it make them walk or run funny, so to speak, differently than your normal gait?
To the naked eye, you would probably not see a difference, actually. There's On the page of the publication, there's a video, and I think also on the Science Friday webpage. However, we did measure some basic kinematics, so the movements of the joints, basically. And we did see that with the assistance profile that produced the highest reduction in metabolic cost, we did see that it increased the knee extension a little bit. But it's not visually perceivable.
Mm-hmm. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking with Philippe Malcolm at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Now, you said 5% difference. Is that a meaningful difference?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think before, with exosuits, we were only capable to reduce the metabolic cost of walking. Just the fact of being able to reduce the metabolic cost of running is like a new benchmark, and can lead to a lot of applications, maybe for recreational or injured athletes and such. Yeah, we're not really sure if it's perceivable. I think if you would compare it, I saw on the website of Science Friday that there were comparisons to like footwear. With footwear, the reductions that are possible by reducing the waists are in the order of a few percent. So right now, it's still, I would say, comparable to having like the best possible shoes. However, we're sure that further improvements are possible simply because this was just very preliminary research.
Is it possible that you could modify it or change it to be used in rehab? People who've had injuries need to get back. Would it be useful?
Definitely. And that's definitely one of the applications that we're thinking all about, and that would already be practically possible using an off-board activation unit, because like you wouldn't need to leave the treadmill necessary. And right now it's optimized for reducing the metabolic energy costs of running, but it could be optimized for any other given objective, like for example, reducing the strain in a particular muscle that's injured would probably require some type of activation with a different magnitude and different timing. So yeah, that would definitely be an interesting future goal.
I mean, well, one last question. I have about 30 seconds. Are there athletes now, like top class athletes, who run differently, like you're making these people run on their treadmill? Are you copying something that's already being done, but doing it better?
We're not necessarily making the running movement itself more efficient. If you would replicate the movement from the exosuit without the exosuit, that's probably not going to help you. Instead, the goal of this research is to find the optimal assistance profile and movement profile for the human plus the exosuit. So that's actually a different situation than the human only running. It's optimizing for the human plus the exosuit.
All right, I got to run. I want to, so to speak, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today. Philippe Malcolm, assistant professor at the University of Nebraska in Omaha. One last thing before we go. It's almost time for Cephalopod Week. Yeah, we at Science Friday have teamed up with Atlas Obscura for a series of cephalo parties in New York, L.A., Chicago, San Francisco. For more information and to buy tickets, go to sciencefriday.com/movienight. That's sciencefriday.com/movienight. It's Cephalopod Week in New York, LA, Chicago, San Francisco, sciencefriday.com/movienight. BJ Lienerman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.